and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. My name's Jeremy Gordon, and I'm very pleased to be joined on the podcast today by Troy Asset Management's James Harries. James is the lead manager of a growing number of income portfolios, including the $760 million Trojan Global Income Fund and Securities Trust of Scotland, after Troy won the mandate to run the investment trust in 2020. Troy, as a firm, very much positions itself as protecting investors' wealth during volatile market conditions, much like we have today, making now a good time to talk to James and see how that's been working out. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, we've seen quite a downturn in markets recently. And in your latest fund fact sheets, you discuss a recent trip to the US, meeting all sorts of companies in person for the first time in a long time. Did you come away feeling optimistic or not?
Well, it's funny you should say that. And it's a good question, because I think most fund managers, most global fund managers anyway, if they're lucky enough to be able to, should go to the States once a year at least. Because you get there. Well, because it stops you being too bearish, because you get and you think this is fantastic. The economy's so big and everyone's so bullish and the businesses are so fantastic. And you usually come away really enthused and full of ideas. And it was great to go back to New York and go back to the States and to meet lots of companies. But I have to say that it didn't have quite that effect this year. The companies themselves were a good deal more downbeat than usual. I mean, still, you know, they're still optimistic in America because that's their way. But they were seeing a lot of inflationary pressure at every level of their businesses. They're all preparing for a more difficult time. Jamie Dimon, the boss of JP Morgan, described it as a hurricane on the horizon that's coming this way. And maybe they should be a bit more careful. Interesting enough, the only business where things were absolutely booming was Canadian National, who moved commodities around the States.
They're a railroad company, are they?
Indeed, yes. But otherwise, I came away thinking, crumbs, you know, that these businesses are beginning to recognize that there is a more difficult period coming.
Okay. And did that recall any previous times you'd gone over? It was more bearish, was it?
It was more marked than it had been in previous times. Because I do think, you know, we've moved into a different world, really. We've moved into a world where we have the end of free money. And, you know, that's just a fundamental change and is going to have big macro and micro implications. And the micro implications are microeconomic, i.e. company specific, are being picked up by the management teams of these companies. And so they're preparing themselves for a more difficult time.
Okay. I mean, I suppose coming away from that, Have you been doing anything? We can talk about your funds in more detail shortly, but have you been doing anything more differently, or is that just something you bear in mind?
The first point to make is that Troy, as you well know, is known for seeking to preserve capital as well as grow it year on year. And we're always thinking as much about the downside as we are about the upside. And you may have heard me say this before, but bubbles are problematic as an investor, because you can look like a fool before the bubble or you can look like a fool after the bubble. And it's generally speaking much better to look like a fool before, even though it doesn't feel like it. So 12 or 18 months ago, you know, we were pretty cautious about the outlook. We were positioned for that. We were invested in a number of businesses which we felt to be resilient and durable, and that we could say something sensible about what they might look like in 3, 5, 7, 10 years' time. But they weren't really the companies that the market was excited about, and therefore our performance looked pretty pedestrian. But since things have got more difficult, then things have come our way. To directly answer your questions, does it mean that we've changed the way we do things? The answer is no, because we've always focused on quality businesses. And by that, we mean businesses that have a high return on capital employed, that are sustained by identifiable competitive advantages. Now, the best defense from a more inflationary time is those same competitive advantages, which allow you to raise prices over time without unduly diminishing the demand for your products. And we have seen that come through in our companies, and I'm happy to talk in more detail about how we think about that.
Yeah, I mean, can you give a couple of examples of companies that have been able to raise prices? Well,
it's interesting, because a lot of people have been very downbeat on the staples sector for a long time, on the basis they think that brands have had their day and that companies are growing this quickly and that their competitive advantages are being eroding. And at the margin, all of that is true. One of the things about, for instance, consumer staples companies is that they've been dealing with inflation for decades. In terms of time, and they've been dealing with inflation in emerging markets serially forever. And so they understand how they do it, they understand how it works, they understand how to raise price. Furthermore, they have inherent competitive advantages relating to brands, relating to scale, relating to distribution, scope and density. And of course, their products are, you know, they're staples for a reason. They're things that people habitually buy. And so they're often viewed, companies like this, as nominal bonds. As correlated with interest rates. Whereas in fact, they're much more like index linked bonds because over time they can raise price. And so if you looked at the most recent results from staples, this consumer staples companies that we own, they've been pretty robust, not surprisingly. Some more so than others. So for instance, a company like Hershey that we own dominates the US chocolate market. You know, when chocolate is the quintessential impulse buy, when you feeling a bit low and you want to borrow chocolate, you don't care that much how much it costs. And Hershey's done very well as a result. It has explicit, obvious pricing power. Other companies within the sector, such as, I'm sure we might comment on Unilever, do have pricing power, but they have to demonstrate it over longer periods because they don't have such explicit pricing power. But overall, you know, the sector's been pretty robust and we would expect it to continue to be so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that probably is something we'll come back on to. Let's zoom out a bit and talk a bit more kind of what you specifically do in your funds. You talked about this focus on quality companies across Troy. How do you, you know, in the Trojan Global Income Fund and Securities Trust of Scotland, how do you kind of take that and run with it? Are you just looking at the same universe of companies and then picking out the highest yielding ones, or how's it work?
No, if only with that simple. And just for a second, we've been talking about inflation and yes, various things. You know, we're not managing the portfolio based upon an inflation forecast. It's important people understand that. But inflation is relevant to the backdrop, and I'm sure we'll return to it. But to answer your question, what we're trying to do is produce above average returns relative to our peers with below average volatility. And the way we try and do that at Troy is we try to invest in a portfolio, a fairly concentrated portfolio, 33 stocks in the portfolio, of exceptional, resilient, high-quality companies. And then we allow those businesses to compound over time. We have very low turnover at Troy of about 10%. Actually, it's been 9% since 2016, but across our funds, which means that our holding periods are about 10 years. And we firmly believe that having a high-quality, settled portfolio that you're allowed to compound is how you make real money, rather than continuous buying and selling of shares. So high-quality portfolio in the first place, very low turnover, and concentrating on businesses that we think are inherently pretty resilient, pretty predictable. And in that way, that leads to us producing the sort of return profile which I described.
Mm. And where do dividends come into that?
Well, because we want to have a balance between income and capital growth. So you touched on the universe at Troy. We have about 170, 180 companies globally that we use to populate our portfolios. And we have a multi-asset fund, the Trojan Fund. We have a UK income fund. We have a global equity fund, the global income fund. They're all various sort of slightly different flavors, but they're all very much identifiably Troy portfolios. We also, of course, have a global scope and a need to produce income. So in a nutshell, what we end up doing is we, over the last few years, and in fact, my personal track record going back 16 years, we've delivered about 2.7 to 3% in terms of income, and about 6% in terms of capital growth. And we've done it with some of the lowest volatility, if not the lowest volatility in the sector. So what we're seeking to do really is that for those with irreplaceable capital and in need of income, and those two things often coincide in retirement, we want to be producing people enough income so they can cover their day-to-day expenditure, but also by the rule of 72, double their capital every sort of 10 to 12 years. And that's what we have delivered over the years.
Okay. Well, so that, you know, that adds up to maybe 9% annualized returns. And that's been during a period where inflation has been very low. It has been an extraordinary period for global equities, where managers focusing on all out growth have delivered much higher returns on that. Do you think people do need to wake up to the fact that that's not going to continue?
Well, it's very interesting. There's two parts to that question. Is 9% a decent return? And secondly, you know, what the outlook might we be facing relative to the past?
Yeah.
It's interesting. In the 10 years, I mean, you may recall I was a previous employer before where I ran a global income fund for 10 years.
Yeah.
We produced that sort of return. But because that period contained the global financial crisis, we were 2% ahead of the benchmark broadly for the global index over that 10-year period. We were the top performing in the sector. We grew to £5 billion. Someone had to mention it. And everyone thought it was fantastic. The return we generated since we've been at Troy is about the same. It just looks rather more pedestrian, as you suggest, relative to the index, which has been incredibly buoyant. Now, my contention to you would be that both conservative investing and income investing tend to wax and wane in terms of their popularity, dependent upon what the market overall is delivering you. And when it's delivering high double digits, then both the sorts of returns that we generate plus the balance between income and capital, which we offer, both get a bit lost in these fantastic amounts of money that everybody are making. But we have to remember it's been an absolutely extraordinary period. We've had basically zero interest rates and virtually zero inflation, allowing governments and central banks to have incredibly positive and supportive policy, both monetary and fiscal, which has led markets to lead up to a point where they were, on some measures, more expensive than they've ever been, and are certainly towards the upper end of the historic valuation range. And so from here, it would strike me that if you can, not every year, not guaranteed, not in a straight line, but say that your portfolio is both compounding capital at a much higher rate than the underlying market, which we are, and can have a forward expected return idea. You know, we're producing a 5.5% free cash flow yield, which we think will pretty consistently grow at about 5%, leading you to this sort of 9 to 11% overall expected return. Well, if we can offer that at a time of great uncertainty and in a way that doesn't scare people too much because the volatility is quite low, particularly for folks with irreplaceable capital in need of income, well, I think that all makes a great deal of sense in terms of where one might consider allocating capital.
Okay, interesting. Well, so I suppose we've already brought it out a bit, but to bring out your process a bit more, to make it a bit more concrete, I'll give you an easy one first. What's an example of a stock where you feel it's worked particularly well? And then how about a stock where you feel the process has gone wrong a bit and you've maybe had to sell out or make a change?
Yeah, so a good example would be something like ADP. This is an outsourced HR software business in the United States. These are lovely businesses. The impetus to outsource your HR function gets greater as the complexity of HR increases. And therefore, companies can use it from a positive perspective, because if you do a good job in terms of HR, it's aids recruitment. And from a negative perspective, you get it wrong, it's increasing your liability. So the impetus to outsource it is increasing. It remains fairly underpenetrated. Lots of companies haven't yet done this. It's a very fragmented industry, and ADP's one, if not the best. ADP and Paychex are both absolutely excellent companies. We have both. We bought this pretty much in the teeth of the financial crisis, in the most recent financial crisis, a COVID crisis in March 2020, because obviously people were very, very worried about prospects for employment, quite reasonably. But our view was, first of all, we felt this business would be far more robust than many expected. And secondly, that the time to be buying a business like this, surely, that's focused on recruitment and people, is when people are most bearish on that particular sector. And so we were able to buy it on a very attractive cash flow yield, and it's done very well for us since then. This is for a business, in terms of the balance between income quality and growth, high returns on capital that generates, consistent growth that it generates, the capital like business model, it's a software business effectively. That's exactly the sort of thing that we want to be doing. And so that's what, so we're very happy with that holding.
Thanks, James. What about an example of a work less well?
Well, we had an investment in a business called IG Group, which is a UK spread betting business. And we, because it's dominant in its sector, it has the tightest spreads that it offers its customers, and therefore has a sustainable competitive advantage. We felt that it was excellent, you know, really well placed to not only dominate the sector, but also take advantage of or allow other customers to take advantage of a more volatile period. And I think we got that right. You know, going into the problems created by COVID, this business was trading very, very nicely. And remained, in our eyes, very inexpensive and well-placed. Unfortunately, the company then did an acquisition of a company called Tasty Trade, which was a recently established futures and options broker and education platform, as they call it. Struck me as more like a sort of YouTube channel. And they paid $1 billion, 8.6 times sales, and raised a load of equity to do it, which we weren't very happy about, not least because the... they did it using a piece of COVID legislation, which meant they could raise that amount of capital without having to ask the shareholders. So we weren't very happy about that, both with regards to the deal that they'd done or the manner in which it had been done. And so we ultimately, having expressed our views to the company, decided to sell. So that was an example where we went in, I think, for the right reasons, but something changed and caused us to change our mind.
Okay. And another fairly recent sale is Fevertree. Is that right in some of your portfolios?
Only in the in Securities Trust of Scotland. Okay. We hold Domino's Pizza in the open-ended strategy, which we love.
Yeah.
We couldn't buy more Domino's Pizza because we own a lot of it as a house. But as some stock became available, we switched Fevertree into Domino's so that the open-ended structure and the closed-ended structure are now aligned. So it's not a particularly brilliant example.
Okay, then. And, well, you don't buy and sell too often in general, but Admiral, the insurer, is quite a recent buy. How does that fit with your approach?
Yeah. So, first of all, we funded it from... GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, which is known as a blue chip in the UK market. And, you know, we've had a long history with this business, but it it would be towards the bottom end of the sort of quality companies that we would like to own in the portfolio. And for a number of reasons, it's done really well because, of course, they're splitting off their consumer arm, which Unilever bid for, which I think highlights the value in that area because the dollar's been very strong and they've got a lot of dollar earnings, obviously, because they're inherently splitting up and dropping their dividend and right-sizing the capital structure of both businesses. I think, generally speaking, the market's been more bullish on that company and the shares have performed very well. At the same time, Admiral Group had done very poorly because it gone up a lot during COVID because we were all paying. I'm a customer of Admiral, coincidentally.
So
we're all
paying
our premiums without driving anywhere. And so the share price did this. And then that's all completely come out, so to speak. So it was very timely from both an income and capital perspective to be switching one into the other. The thing about Admirals is really interesting. It's not the sort of business we would generally go for. Insurance companies tend to be quite complicated, quite opaque. But it's a bit of an exception to the rule. And I must say, I've been a bit remiss in this because I've known of Admiral Group, not least as a customer, for years. But I hadn't really, we have an analyst on our UK income team called Anirudha Kulkarni, who did a really excellent piece of work and teased out on, you know, what makes this a special business. And I hadn't fully appreciated that. And the reason it's a special business is grounded in this, because it concentrates on a cohort, which I'm afraid to say I am no longer a part, which is young men in fast cars. What this means is that they have a great data set for this area. They're able to price for that. And very unusually, and most importantly, it means that they make a profit on their underwriting through the cycle. It's actually very unusual for an insurance company. Usually they make a loss on their underwriting and they make up on profits. But because they're able to make a profit on their underwriting over the cycle, they then offload the insurance risks to Munich Re, which is a big, ponderous, low-return German reinsurer that we wouldn't own in the portfolio. So Admiral offload the risk but keep the profitability. They're also very, very tight on costs. It's a very tightly managed business. So you put all that together, a particular data set leading to particular pricing, which leads to particularly profitable underwriting, a low cost base, and having outsourced the insurance risk, it makes for a very high return on equity business, very limited capital requirements, and to us, a very an exceptionally high quality, you know, income contributor to the portfolio. So, you know, we were very happy that we were able to buy it at about 12.8 times price to earnings. And that looks very inexpensive to us. And we'll probably like to hold it for 10 years or more.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Let's talk about Unilever a little bit, because it's a stock that kind of might exemplify Troy's approach. And it hasn't really been doing well for a few years. It's been attacked by some other fund managers. What do you think's been going wrong at Unilever? And what do you want to see improve? Or has it been unfairly maligned?
Well, it's a bit of, but I mean, let's think about it. So there are lots of things to like about Unilever. I mean, after all, it's generated a very attractive return on capital employed for a long period of time, although it's come down a little bit, still high relative to many other businesses. It has lots of the sort of attributes that we're looking for in business, in the sense that it has repeat, familiar staples type products that people buy habitually and become very attached to. It has an amazing brand and a broadness and depth of distribution, notably in emerging markets, which is basically impossible to replicate or to build out unless you throw an incredibly large amount of money and an awful long time at. It has a range of large, identifiable, popular brands. And you put all that together and it represents a very attractive global income asset. If we're looking for something that could reliably, dependably generate a return between income and capital over time, and grow the income derived from high returns on capital employed, themselves supported by identifiable competitive advantages, well, tip, Unilever's all of those things. It is true that it's had a bit more of a difficult time recently. And that's for a number of reasons. The first is it's not unusual for these businesses to, over time, alter their portfolio. You know, the way you run a staples business is you basically run your winners and you cut your losers, or you grow your flowers and pull up the weeds, or however you want to describe it. But they do manage their portfolio. So the businesses or the brands are becoming a bit less current or growing, but slowly they tend to sell, and then they buy in newer, more exciting areas or brands that they can then put through their distribution platform and make a lot of money out. So when Unilever's been doing this, arguably it could have done it a bit more aggressively with a bit more zip. You know, you look at a company like P&G, which was in a similar position to my mind where Unilever is a few years ago, where it was seen as a bit sluggish and a bit dull, and their brand's quite not at the cutting edge, and they required a bit of heavy lifting, a bit of streamlining and increasing in productivity. And they did do that, and the P&G share price has done very well as a result. And I think perhaps the similar thing could be said of Unilever. It could it could potentially have done a bit more. I think in their defense, you know, they've got a big, as I say, emerging market footprint. And it's very easy for us all to forget that COVID hit emerging markets very hard, and it still hits emerging markets hard. You know, there's articles in The Economist this weekend about terrible things that, you know, the lack of education that many people have suffered as a result of COVID, notably in emerging markets. And it just reminds us that this hasn't gone away. And, you know, hopefully it will at some point. We'll get it, will be in the rearview mirror, and Unilever will benefit from that. And you could argue that they have been a little bit lackluster in their communication and so on. But I wouldn't want to overplay that. I think actually, you know, often the narrative can follow the share price, because share price doesn't do so well. People get down on both the management team and the company, and I think somewhat unfairly, perhaps. So, you know, we're happy to continue to hold that business, and I suspect we will do for some time to come. We're looking forward to some better years ahead. When, okay. When you look at the current valuation, it looks very attractive.
Yeah, so you say it's part of their model, kind of buying in growth. You support their kind of slight, I think maybe it's sort of maybe healthcare and beauty areas they want to go towards a bit more. Something, you know, Terry Smith has criticised, says they don't know anything about it. But you support them moving into those higher growth areas.
Well, I just think that it is perfectly normal for these businesses to offload some of the slower growing areas and to buy in other areas which are growing more quickly. And use their distribution power to make a lot of money out of those areas. So I think it's, I don't think it's that surprising.
Okay. Thanks, James. For the benefit of the listeners, I probably should have done this earlier when we're talking about performance, but just to kind of, maybe it's an appropriate moment to run through a few performance figures, which do highlight that you've been doing well this year. So in the 6 months to the end of May, up 10.9% versus a 3.2% loss for the MSCI World Index, and also quite a way ahead of peers in the IO global sector. And that leads us to, since launch in 2016, you're up 61.8% again to the end of May, again ahead of the sector average of 53.2%. And a bit behind the 77.8% gain for the MSCI World, as we've discussed. I suppose, you know, since you, looking back to when you joined Troy, basically, are you happy with how it's gone so far?
Well, it's kind of easy to bring up performance, particularly at this moment when it, you know, I think we're right. I think I'm right in saying we're top quartile, you know, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year.
And yeah.
If you add it to my previous track record, 10-year, 15-year, 16-year, you know, it's a more difficult market. It's Troy's market, and our relative numbers are relatively good. So thank you for mentioning that. It goes back to what I was saying before. The returns we generated are actually very consistent with both what we've done in the past and what we've done in a variety of different sort of market cycles. And if you can consistently generate the sort of return that we have done since we've been at Troy, then you'll do fine. There just will be periods when it looks a bit pedestrian, and those the years we've recently had are some of those. But in more difficult times, and as I mentioned back in sort of 07, 08, during the global financial crisis, the sort of returns that we're generating looked excellent. So, you know, we're going to keep doing what we do, and the market will no doubt keep doing what it does. But I do think that it's perfectly credible to run a strategy like this and to produce, through a balance of income and growth, a perfectly decent return, both in absolute terms, but also relative to, you know, importantly relative to our peers, but also relative to the market.
Okay. And well, I suppose with strong performance, say, for example, you hold big positions in tobacco companies like British American Tobacco, which are up quite a lot in a bear market. Does that put you under pressure to find more new ideas than you might be ordinarily comfortable with, I suppose?
Well, I guess inherent is that in this notion that we have kind of very low turnover in our portfolios. It's not in our, you know, we don't continuously look to morph the portfolio for any particular kind of macro outlook or inflation outlook. We don't buy and sell companies based upon a view of what they might do in the next 6 months or a year. We don't stray into sectors that we think are inherently low quality or low return on capital employed.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not no turnover, we are low turnover. So we will sometimes take action. That's as a result of if a company becomes really egregiously valued, although if you're prepared to hold a business over a very long period of time, there will be times when it looks up with events in terms of valuation. That's fine with us. There might be other times when we've got a better idea, and that's fine. The competition for capital means that we do take action in the portfolio. And the third is if we get it wrong, and that does happen. Specifically with regard to your question, it's a really interesting area because going back 12 or 18 months when we scaled, I'd like to think of them as nicotine consumer products companies as opposed to tobacco, because they won't be tobacco companies much longer.
Okay.
Migrating everybody onto their next gen products, which turn out to be at scale more profitable than the traditional combustible business. And are taxed more lowly because governments quite reasonably or quite, you know, sensibly are trying to encourage people to switch from the more harmful to less harmful product, and that creates better profitability. We were at a time when we felt markets to be highly speculative. We wrote about it at the time. You know, we had meme stocks and SPACs, and we had that space investment trust launched, and incredibly high valuations and amazing, you know, basically what we had is something that was akin to 2000, not because it was full of unprofitable technology companies trading at crazy valuations, although there was plenty of that, because the FANGs, for want of a better expression, the big high quality global technology companies are profitable, are decent businesses, are decent value. They don't yield very much. They're not particularly good for us. And we can talk about that. You know, we don't own the FANGs, but we don't own the companies are being disrupted by the FANGs either. So we're trying to steer a middle course. And that's been demonstrated recently. But it was just a time where it was just transparently a very speculative time. And the reason it was like 2000 is because what created the final blow off top in 2000 was the authorities acting, in my view, pretty recklessly, because they were terrified about the Y2K problem, if you recall. You know, this idea that everything was going to crash as computers ticked over into the new millennium. Well, COVID provided the same thing, the same externality, if you like, the same Deus Ex Machina, the thing that created the spark for the authorities to really go for it and to have monetary and fiscal policy, which in retrospect probably was very irresponsible. I mean, gosh, look at what's going on in Sri Lanka. I mean, that is the best example globally of what can go really badly wrong. If you spend money willy-nilly and then print money to fund it and get economic collapse. Now, that's happening in much less awful way in most countries around the world. They all spent money like there was no tomorrow and then used printing presses effectively via monetary policy to support it. And we're reaping the whirlwind now, because while they were doing that and there was no inflation, that was fine. But as soon as inflation appears, you can't do that any longer. And so they're having to rein it in. But having pushed asset prices to a level where their very valuation creates fragility, because, you know, as asset prices fall, it creates all sorts of problems all over the place. As inflation rates go up, it creates all sorts of problems all over the place, as we're seeing, and so on. So that was the backdrop. I know this is a long answer to your question, but it's important because at that time there were lots of cheap assets, but there were really very few high quality cheap assets. And you could identify perhaps oil or mining, banks, or nicotine consumer products companies. The difference is that first three are not good businesses. They're inherently cyclical. They're inherently capital intensive. They're dependent upon the commodity price everywhere, which you have no control. In the case of the banks, they're highly levered. They're not the sort of businesses either that you might want to own into a downturn. Whereas nicotine consumer goods companies are excellent businesses. They have high returns on capital. They're capital light. They have distribution, brands, all the things I've been talking about, and a high degree of predictability in terms of their cash flows. After all, the sort of algorithm, if you like, of mid-single digit, high single digit, year-on-year EPS growth funding a decent and growing dividend is completely unbroken. It's completely untroubled. The sector is dramatically derated, obviously as a result of the fact that it's unpalatable to some, but also because of idiosyncratic occasions such as BAT buying the rump of Reynolds in 2016, which they paid the wrong price for. They overleveraged their balance sheet and it led to a big steep decline in the share price. But what that ended up meaning is that we were able to buy into an inherently very attractive industry from a return perspective, but a very attractive valuation at a time when the broader market itself was priced to deliver you almost nothing because of the widespread speculative backdrop. So it just struck us as just an incredible, idiosyncratic global income opportunity, and it remains so.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I suppose moving on from tobacco, something I had missed was that late last year you launched the Trojan Ethical Global Income Fund. Tell us a bit about that. Why was that, and how does it differ from your other funds? I guess it doesn't own tobacco, I think.
Indeed. So basically, we had a client who said, we like your approach, we like the team, we like the return profile, we like Troy. But we don't want to invest in nicotine secured products or a number of different sectors. Would you mind launching an ethical version of the strategy for us? We're like, no, absolutely fine. If that's what you'd like, we're very happy to do it. So what we got is a portfolio that excludes specific sectors, including alcohol and tobacco, but also other areas such as high interest lending, pornography, gambling, oil and gas, and so on. Which we then, armaments, which we don't then include in the portfolio. Now, but at the same time, we're trying to make it as consistent with the unconstrained fund, if you like, as possible. So there are four companies that effectively we can't own in the ethical fund, which is three nicotine consumer products companies and Diageo. And we replaced them with effectively the next best ideas that we have in the universe. Now, what we didn't do is try and replicate the kind of the attributes that you get from the nicotine consumer products companies, because they're idiosyncratically, as I think I've hoped I've demonstrated, in our minds, an incredibly attractive investment, but there isn't anything else quite like it in the market. So what we've done is replace them with other businesses that we really like, but which are a little bit more expensive than tobacco or nicotine consumer product companies, because there's nothing as cheap as tobacco. And so we end up with a portfolio that's very similar, but which is doesn't include those particular sectors which many wish to exclude from their investments, which therefore has a slightly lower yield, but is probably growing rather more quickly. So we hope over the, in the short term, it's very difficult to for the funds to be exactly the same, but over the longer term, we suspect they'll produce quite a similar return, just made up of a slightly different balance between capital and income.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, what are a couple of those next best ideas? I mean, maybe I'll mention one that I think caught my eye was Universal Music.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Coloplast, Christian Hansen, Universal Music would all be three really good examples. I mean, in terms of Universal Music, this is an amazing business. I mean, it owns, I think I'm right in saying, a third of all music ever created, as effectively a royalty on all of those songs that we all like listening to. And what's nice about that is it's kind of platform agnostic. So you don't have to work out whether it's Spotify or whether it's Apple Music, whether whatever is going to be playing the music, because you own the upstream resource, if you like, and you make money however people consume it. The second thing to say is that it's...
So in a sense, you don't have to worry about some kind of massive technological disruption.
Yeah, because you own what everybody wants.
Okay.
I don't know what your favorite song is, but that's not going to change depending on what platform you're listening to, and nor me. And the second point is, it's not like Netflix, for instance, which, the end game for a business like Netflix, where you have to continuously in an arms race for content and for eyeballs, means that it's actually, the end state profitability of that industry may well not be attractive. Whereas for music, you'll listen to your favorite song again and again and again and again and again. Whereas I would say to you that you could probably only watch Bridgerton once, if at all. You get my point. So it's a very different business, and as a result, it's growing pretty quickly. It's pretty attractively valued, and we thought it was an interesting asset for this portfolio. And actually, all three of those are good examples whereby they will all, I suspect, find their way into the unconstrained fund, but at a time when the valuation of those businesses relative to nicotine consumer products companies may have corrected somewhat. So we, there is a consistency about how we manage PIF funds.
I see. Okay, thanks very much. Well, thanks, James. I think that's everything I wanted to ask about investment, really. Maybe lastly, we can give people a bit more of a sense of what else you like to do. What are some of your other interests outside fund management?
Well, I mean, just first of all, thank you very much for having me on. I mean, it's a really...
My pleasure.
It's a really timely time for it to happen. There are many investors around the world who have beginning to come around once again to a rather more conservative income focused style of investment. There's a change of legislation in Australia, meaning that pension funds offer it. We had a call with one of the biggest pools of capital in the world last week. Things have changed.
Can you explain a bit more? What's that legislative change in Australia?
Yeah, so the regulator in you'll know that in Australia have these huge superannuation funds.
Right.
There was an article about this in the FT last week. And they have, it turns out, they fear a little bit too much growth in their portfolios, it seems, and therefore their performance hasn't been quite what they would like it to have been recently. And of course, the sort of underlying factor to this, and related to my point about irreplaceable capital and even needs of income, is that the underlying members of those pension schemes are aging. And so it's felt that they ought to have within their cohort of managers someone who is a bit more low beta, conservative, income bearing, low volatility, which I think is fascinating as a forward-looking piece of regulation, was a change in legislation to almost mandate offering income investing, given what you said at the beginning about whether income investing is, is it attractive? Should we be doing it? How's it done relative? How should it do in the future? I thought that was fascinating. So I think that just as a sort of an expression of how things have changed and how the future looks a bit different to the past, about the fundamentals in terms of it being an era of, you know, the era of free money and endless quantitative easing is over.
And
we're moving into a bit more of a sober time, if you like, a bit more of a difficult time. And I think the way we manage money is therefore coming back into vogue, back into fashion, not just within individuals, but also with larger pools of institutional capital.
Yeah.
Anyway, time will tell.
Very interesting, yeah.
It is. I think it's fascinating, obviously. So to answer your question, what do I do when I'm not doing fund management? But I guess a bit like Universal
Music. I'm sure you're a busy man.
Yeah. yes. Well, I like it that way. But two things, really. I like listening to music, which is kind of relevant to what we're saying about Universal Music. And I like exercise. I like running around outside. And I actually think, you know, I think the benefits of exercise weren't really understood 20 or 25 years ago in terms of how important it is for your mental well-being. But I think we do understand it now. And, you know, we're not saving lives here, but fund management can be quite stressful sometimes. And I think, you know, physical fitness and making sure that you look after yourself is an important part of managing your mental well-being as well. So I think it's important.
Okay, so you're a keen runner.
Yeah, running, cycling, swimming, tennis, whatever I can find time to do.
Okay, good stuff. Okay, well, thanks very much, James. We've taken up, you know, enough of your time today.
Well, there's an awful lot to cover at the moment, but thank you very much for your questions.
Yeah.
Speak soon.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, thanks again for coming on, James. Great to have you. And I suppose that the last thing to say from me is thank you very much, everyone, for listening at home. And please join us again soon for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts.